أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد رسول
الله. I'm your host, Amr Rashid. Today we have our 11th program in our series dealing with the political system of Islam. Today we'll be discussing the guiding principles of Islamic government. I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Last week in our 10th program in the series, we had an excellent discussion of the concept of shura, or consultation, in Islamic state. Could I have you, perhaps, before we get into today's program, very quickly summarize the main points that we touched on in that program?
Certainly. We mentioned that mutual consultation, or shura, is a very important principle in Islamic government. And the necessity for shura, or imperative of shura, is something which is proven amply from the Quran, from the prophetic saying and behavior, as well as the action of the rightly guided caliphs. We also indicated that the scope of shura should include all issues of public interest, but not necessarily every minor administrative decision. However, we said also that if the administrative decision is of such importance and magnitude that it requires shura, then it should also be subject to shura, or consultation. We indicated also that the results of shura should actually be binding on the ruler, or else it becomes a mockery to consult and not to take opinions, especially in significant issues. As far as the mechanism of implementation of consultation or shura, we said that this could vary depending on the issue and depending on the circumstances. It could be in a form of public referendum, just like the early discussion in the mosque of the Prophet and during the days of the guided caliphs. Or it could take place through representative assembly representing the people. Or in some cases, consultation could be with the experts who have certain expertise in technical matters, but still subject to the control and approval of the representative council, whatever it's called. And we also discussed briefly about the cases where there is difference of opinion or position between the head of the state and that council, and the possible way of resolving that particular conflict. And finally, the issue of possibility of removal of the head of the state if people are not satisfied with his performance, especially if he's committing a grave act against the Quran and Sunnah. If I may just add one little thing here that we didn't have time last week to mention, is that in Islam the ruler is a little different also from ruler in other so-called democracies, because in democracies the ruler is essentially accountable before the representative council. In Islam, he is above all held responsible before Allah in terms of his own conscience and seeking the pleasure of Allah, not disobeying him. Secondly, he is responsible before a representative council who could possibly also remove him from office. And thirdly, he is responsible before even any person, any of the members of the public of his community. He can stop him in the street, as it happened with the rightly guided caliphs, and question him on certain issues. And his responsibility or accountability is not only on administrative decisions, but even on his own moral behavior as an individual. There's nothing called private, because he should be the good model and example for the Muslim. So in that sense, it's even wider and graver responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, turning now to further discussion of some of the guiding principles of Islamic government, a common concern of all people in all times is the question of justice in government. How is that question viewed in the political system of Islam?
Well, as a principle, it applies to the political system as well as other areas also, even on the individual level. So perhaps it might be useful to just give a few references in the Quran to show the importance of the principle. In one of the earlier programs, we quoted the verse 25 in chapter 57 in the Quran, which showed the whole objective of sending messengers or prophets and sending revelation with them is not just the spiritual matter, but also so that people stand up for justice. The Quran also in numerous places emphasizes the same principle. In 1690, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُ بِالْعَدْلِ وَالْإِحْسَانِ, God ordains or enjoins justice and goodness. In chapter 4, verse 58, that it says that God or Allah ordains you to give trust to the people, and when you rule among people, that you should rule in justice. Even in the justice in the spoken word is also emphasized. In chapter 6, verse 152, it says, وَإِذَا قُلْتُمْ فَعَدِلُوا, when you say something, then say a word of truth and justice, even if it is against your relatives. Not only this, but even in realization that some people may have certain biases against people who are not totally like them, the Quran warns in chapter 5, verse 9, it says, don't let your aversion or hatred of a people, or even aversion to people, cause you to be unjust. Be just. This is closer to piety. The counterpart, or the oppression and injustice, is as much condemned in the Quran as justice is commended. In the Quran, for example, in chapter 26, verse 227, like many other verses in a similar nature, emphasize that one of the reasons of the destruction of nations in the past was that they were oppressive. The prophetic saying are also along the same line. In one famous saying of the Prophet, which is narrated in both Bukhari and Muslim, the Prophet indicated that among seven categories of good people who would be under the shadow of protection of Allah in the day where there is no protection but His, and he says, Imamun Adil, a ruler who rules injustice. The Prophet also warned, as narrated in Muslim, that al-dhulmu dhulumat, which means oppression, is like darkness, or will cause the person to suffer in the darkness on in the day of judgment. In both Bukhari and Muslim, it says that God would leave the unjust or oppressor, but when He takes him, He would really give him severe punishment. So as a principle, it's very much emphasized, as you might have seen also from the verses cited. It doesn't just talk about justice in general, but some of them seem to imply also clearly justice in government, which is an important part of the implementation of the this value.
Well, I'd like to deal with the scope of the levels of implementation of justice. Could you perhaps elaborate a bit on that?
You mean beyond the broader principle emphasis on it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can look at it almost on any individual, on any level. On the family level, there is also implementation of justice with respect to what happens during engagement, in marital relationship, marital contract, the rights and duties between husband and wife, the protection of duties and justice in the case of divorce or dissolution of marriage, rights of children, parents and relatives. This was all covered in the social system of Islam as part of the family structure. It could also be justice in terms of individual relationship, not only with his family but with people around him in his own small environment. It could be justice in the level of smaller neighborhoods, as we have seen, for example, in the economic system of Islam, how people would be responsible in any particular locality or neighborhood if one of them spend the night hungry. On the level of the state, we have seen again it entails ruling in justice and fairness, to make sure to provide in basic necessities and needs of people, regardless whether they are Muslims or non-Muslims, everybody should be looked after. It is justice also on the level of the world, on more universal level, in a sense of fighting oppression and tyranny, wherever they are practiced, and to try to liberate people. This is not conquest, it's actually to liberate people from tyrannical forces that is usurping their basic freedoms. In this particular sense, there is no exception for anyone. If you talk about the scope involves everybody, rulers and rule. And in Islam, the ruler doesn't have any special immunity. He's also subject to the same laws as everybody else. There's no exception of someone who, because he's rich or come from a noble family or whatnot. Actually, one of the warnings that Prophet Muhammad made, he said that one of the reasons of the decline of nations before you is that when a person who is rich and noble commits a theft, they let him go. But when a poor steals, they apply the penalty to him. So the scope is, you can almost name any level where justice definitely applies.
Mm-hmm. Well, now another question which is related to justice is the quality of citizens in a truly Islamic state. Could you perhaps explain that situation?
Perhaps another quick cross-reference may be useful. In the beginning also of the Sharia system in Islam, there were more details on that, so we'll just perhaps try to capture the point that would help us understand the topic at hand. But the basic points to relate here is that Islam emphasizes the origin of human equality. Mm-hmm. And we're not here talking about equality of a certain group or segment, but human equality in a sense of equality of all human beings. And as the Quran expresses it in, for example, chapter 49, in the beginning of chapter 4, it shows that all human beings come from the same origin, that is, from same parents. Mm-hmm. All human beings share one basic human nature. All human beings are going to die. All of them are going to stand before Allah or God in the Day of Judgment to give account of their lives. So in that sense, then, the view of Islam is more universal in terms of fundamentals or foundation mm-hmm. of human equality. You might recall the verse, for example, in chapter 49, verse 13. O mankind, we created you males and females, and we multiplied you into nations and tribes, that you may get to know one another. Lo, the noblest of you in the sight of Allah is the most pious, or one who is most Allah-conscious. The Prophet, peace be upon him, Prophet Muhammad also emphasized the same meaning. And he, addressing his people of his time, he said that God or Allah has relieved you from the fanaticism of Jahiliyyah, or the ignorance, days of ignorance prior to Islam, and of its pride in ancestors. Whether you are pious believer, or a person could be either a pious believer or a miserable, wicked person, you are the children of Adam. She uses the very broader term. You are the children of Adam, and Adam was created from dust. That was narrated in At-Tirmidhi and Abu Dawood. Maybe one can add here also that with this broader expression of equality, it means that not only are people equal because they belong to one religion or faith, that it is equality which involves Muslim or non-Muslim under the protection or the administration of an Islamic state, that it involves equality before the law and equality also before the courts of law.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, your answer seems to imply as well the freedom of religion in an Islamic state. Did I interpret that correctly?
Yes, you did. Actually, this is part of the amalgam of freedoms and liberties that Islamic law guarantees. That is, when any government sincerely and truly implement them, this should be the situation. But I'd like to call it more actually, or put the freedom of religion in a broader type of freedom or category, like we can call it, let's say, freedom of conscience. Because freedom of conscience involves both freedom of religion and freedom of expression also. As far as freedom of religion, this is something that the Quran confirms over and over again. Suffice to quote at least one verse in chapter 2, verse 266. La ikraha fi din. It says, let be no compulsion in religion. He can't compel people to believe in any particular religion. And after all, Islam, by definition, is voluntary and conscious submission to the will of God and following His path. So it's illogical to say, you know, you've got to believe. You can't force people to do things, but you can force them to believe things. But freedom of religion also is as much as it's emphasized, there is also emphasis on respect of religion. And that's why, for example, turning away from truth and belief in the supremacy of God after the person has already freely accepted religion, especially if it's done publicly in such a way causing you know, dissent, and sometimes used as legal manipulation to take advantage of the personal law, which varies between Muslims and non-Muslims. We'll talk about that maybe in a later program. To take advantage by legal manipulation of causing commotion in society and disturbing public order is something which is strongly discouraged. So within the reasonable boundaries of respect of religion, not making it like a, you know, play, freedom of religion has been very much emphasized. And that includes also not only the freedom to believe, but the freedom to practice what one in his own conscience wishes to practice. As the Quran puts it, it says in chapter 10, verse 99, if God willed, the whole population of earth, all human beings, would have been believers. And then addresses the Prophet, says, are you going then to force them to be believers? Which means you can't force people to be believers. And another verse in the Quran says, remind, you are only reminder, you are not sent as guardian over them. So fundamental religious freedom is very clearly enshrined in the Quran and prophetic saying.
Well, now how about the other aspect of freedom of conscience? That is the freedom of expression. Can you explain that?
Well, I mean, what they call the other side of
yes.
Yes. Well, the freedom of expression is not only regarded in Islamic political system, as you related at least here, not only regarded as a right, but actually as a duty, as an obligation. In fact, the Quran speaks of the collective duty of Muslims, individuals and collective duty, to ordain the good and forbid the evil. And again, for cross-reference purposes, in the early part of the social system in Islam, under the topic of social responsibility, there were much more detailed discussion of that issue. The Prophet, as narrated in Muslim, said that مَنْ رَأَ مِنْكُمْ مُنْكَرًا فَلْيُغَيِّرُهُ. That is, if any one of you sees something which is indecent, unjust, improper, let him try to change it by hand. If he cannot change it by hand, he should try to change it by his tongue. By the way, tongue here does not necessarily a spoken word. It could also be a written word. And if he's not able to change, that is, neither by hand or by tongue, then let him at least feel bad about it. Let him feel rejecting this kind of act in his own heart. And he said that this is the least of faith, that you can't just be totally apathetic of evil around you. Details, of course, were discussed as to how exactly to do it and under what circumstances would any of these means be used and so on. So we'll just make or refer for further details to that. But more specifically, the Prophet also indicated that ad-din al-nasiha, that religion, true religion, is sincerity and advice. And when they asked him, to whom? He said, sincerity to Allah, sincerity to the Prophet, and he added, sincerity and advice to all Muslims in public or private, that is, as individuals, as and also sincerity and advice to a'imma, which means people in power. Mm-hmm. So the duty to advise those in power, even though you might have already chosen them and agreed to their leadership, mm-hmm. is part of the responsibility. That is why we find Umar, the second caliph after the Prophet, one time he stood and he addressed the people, you know, talking to them about certain issues, and then he said, if you people see in me as a ruler anything crooked or anything that is wrong and improper, please correct me. So one of the people said, sitting there, he said, Umar, if we find some crookedness or wrong action on your part, we will correct it even with our swords. Umar here didn't say arrest him, he's threatening the state or the person of the head of the state. He looked at him and he said, أَلَا لَا خَيْرَ فِيكُمْ إِلَّا لَمْ تَقُلُوهَا. That is, say it, criticize, because there is no good in you people unless you feel free to criticize, and there is no goodness in us if we don't listen to your suggestions and criticism. This is the true spirit of Islam. We're not talking about what people who claim to be Muslims practice, but this is what true Islam means and what true Muslims and committed Muslims have always practiced. Another great Muslim, Ali, the fourth caliph after the Prophet, peace be upon him. In his time, there was a group who deviated and split. Were called Khawarij or Kharijites, as some references call them. And they had a very harsh assessment of Ali. Some of them even considered him not a good believer. They used to attack him and slander. And despite all of that, and despite of their almost call for rebellion against the government or all of this verbal assault, Ali never arrested them. He simply told them, we are not going to initiate or begin any fight with you unless you do that, or unless you start doing corruption on earth, unless you really become violent and do something that is, of course, against the law and against public order, then we will fight you. But otherwise, they were cursing him, and he let them still at large until they do something really punishable by law. And we're talking here about the 7th century in the Christian era. We're not talking about the 20th century. But of course, the question of freedom of expression, like in any other setting or any other place, should be also qualified by the necessity that one should not use that, or abuse it to be more accurate, to slander others, to accuse them or attack them unfairly. A freedom of expression does not mean the freedom also to spread corruption and pornography or things of that sort. So within the reasonable decency, right of others, respective rights of others, public order and security of the state, expression of freedom or expression of opinion is totally free and encouraged. It's a duty.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about the questions of the question of basic personal freedoms? How are these guaranteed in the Islamic political system?
Magna Carta, in other words?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting to notice that many people think that the best document in recent times, you know, about personal freedoms goes back to 1919 in this Magna Carta, which emphasized the rights of people, of course, to have their freedom, and that they would not be arrested arbitrarily without charge, cannot be detained without the specific charge or court order. But in fact, the principle goes much, much before 1919. It goes actually to the 7th century in the Christian era. In fact, there was a case where a person was arrested or detained in the days of the Prophet, peace be upon him. And somebody came to complain to the Prophet. Why? By what guilt was that person taken? And there was silence. The Prophet kept quiet. I'll tell you why. The second time the person asked, why was that person detained? The Prophet kept quiet. The third time the question was asked, and the Prophet kept quiet for a while, and then he ordered his release, which means, as some jurists interpreted, that whoever made the arrest, in terms of the executive branch in the Islamic State, was given three chances in the mosque, because that was in public, to come forward and say, yes, he was arrested or detained because of this or that. So the three chances were given. And since there was no particular charge or evidence presented, he ordered his release. If you really but just change the situation instead of the mosque in a courtroom, it is exactly what happened today, that somebody would be detained for no more than so many hours. And without a specific charge, a person must be released. This is sometimes referred to in legal language as the habeas corpus.
Yes,
you see, the freedom of the person. Furthermore, as the Quran indicates in numerous places, especially in chapter 17, verse 170, أَلَّا تَزِرُ وَازِرَةٌ وَزْرَ أُخْرَى, that no person would be charged with the guilt or mistake done by someone else. As you know, in previous points in history, a person could be punished, a son could be punished for the guilt of his father and the reverse. But in Islam, nobody can pay for the crime or mistake committed by anyone, no matter how close to him. This freedom involves also the freedom of movement. Indeed, some jurists refer to the verse in Quran in chapter 67, particularly verse 15, where God speaks that he created for us the earth, that we should walk into the expanse of the earth and seek his provision. And as such, nobody has the right to impose any restriction on your freedom of movement, except of course in exceptional cases during the warfare, when the state says don't travel to the land of the enemy or whatever. But other than that, people are free to move and live wherever they want. It is unfortunate, as you know, that in our age, in the 20th century, there are places like totalitarian regimes in the Eastern Bloc where people even might not have that much freedom to move. Freedom also involves privacy, the right to privacy. The Quran in chapter 24, verse 27, it says one is not supposed to enter into homes or places of residence without seeking permission of the people. And there is a little interesting story that it was said that Umar once, the second caliph after the Prophet, knew that some people were drinking, which is a violation. So he climbed over the fence and got them. Say, I got you. So one of them said, yes, we are doing wrong, we are drinking. But we did one thing wrong, you did three things which are wrong. He said, how is that? He said, the Quran says you should take permission, and you didn't take permission. Secondly, the Quran says seek permission before entering, and you didn't take. The Quran says you should come from the proper doors, and you came from the defense. And thirdly, the Quran says don't spy, and you spied on us. And Umar had no choice but saying, all right, no punishment can be applied. And what we have called mistaken procedures, even though the person has already been caught doing this. So all of these are just examples of the nature of personal freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have about a minute or so left on the program. Very quickly, are there any other aspects of freedom which you might want to add in the closing minutes?
Okay, perhaps you can put them in a form of more or less like listing. Yes, for example, in our discussion previously in the economic system of Islam, it was emphasized also that the freedom of work, a person is free to work in any profession or any job, so long as it's not forbidden because of its immorality, like, you know, pornography or prostitution, things of that sort. Unless something has been forbidden for all, any person can choose whatever profession or job that he or she prefers. The freedom to learn, and it was indicated also in some occasions in the past that learning is not only a right, it is also a responsibility and a duty on people. The general liberties, to be brief, which relate to human dignity, are all based on a verse in the Quran in chapter 17, in verse 7, that God says that we surely have accorded dignity to the children of Adam. And when it says children of Adam, it means everybody.
Mm-hmm. We'll leave it at that for today. We want to thank you for watching our program. Invite you back next week when we'll continue with our series dealing with the political system of Islam. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.